Okay, let's get started.
Whoa, wait, just a minute, partner.
No.
Guess again, freak boy.
To the Batmobile. Let's go.
AudioTU.com. Another fresh picked pod from AudioTU.com. Shutters Inc. with Shelton Muller.
Hi, and welcome to episode 50 of Shutters Inc. This is Bruce Williams from AudioTU.com, and with me, once again via Skype from Melbourne, Shelton Muller. How are you?
G'day, mate. How are you?
Excellent.
That's good. Oh, let's see. We'll have some news to release very soon on the subject of the magazine, Total Image.
Ooh.
And Better Pictures.
Excellent.
It's all hush-hush. Can't say too much at this stage, but it's very exciting for a struggling publisher.
Wink, wink, nudge, nudge, say no more.
Say no more. That's right. Could be taken on holiday. That's right. Yeah, does she go? Any Python fans out there will get that, of course. Yes. One day we'll break into the parrot sketch, I'm sure. But apart from that, the magazine, of course, is out, and the latest issue, and
yep.
I think we've posted the cover on audiotu.com, haven't we?
Yes.
So everyone can have a look at the way that I've used that portrait of Antonio on the front cover.
Yep.
I'm so thankful we came across that man standing in a doorway, and I'm so thankful for photographing him the way we did, because it turned out to be a great shot. One of my favorites, and I actually have just recently redesigned my business card and wanted to use his picture on my business card as a sort of generic portrait. But everybody says, oh no, everyone will think that's you when you hand them a card. And I thought, okay, all right, might have to come up with a different picture. So apart from that, just basically struggling away and doing all these things. And what about you, Bruce? What's coming up for you?
Well, Dave and I have now officially finished tracking for the album that we're working on.
Which is called?
Which is going by the title of Hard Road Home.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of, well, Dave and I are both influenced by Springsteen. So the influences have been Springsteen, Steve Earle,
right,
Emmylou Harris, sort of that sort of alt-country rock,
okay,
type of thing. And Dave and I are actually going out on Saturday night for a photographic shoot, which I will be shooting. And if you've got any ideas, keen to hear some. Because I must admit, I'm not overly confident with my abilities with the flash, and I don't have a great flash unit. Like, I don't have a Minolta flash unit.
Mm-hmm.
I just have a generic brand, and it's not TTL, so you've sort of got to... And unfortunately, it's one that you cannot back the power off on, which
right.
means the only way you can back the power off is either get further away from the subject or... close your aperture down, but sometimes you don't want to shut the aperture down, so it's on my shopping list to get a decent flash unit. So
yeah, oh look, there's nothing better than the proper flash unit, and I've often bagged flash on and maybe people get the wrong idea. I'm actually a big fan of flash, provided it's properly used.
Yeah.
And Paul Gowder, one of our regular listeners, has actually asked a question about flash that we'll be addressing in this podcast. So Paul,
right,
hang on, mate, we're going to get there in a minute, okay?
Mm.
So you keep listening, Paul. Everybody else, you can do what you like, but Paul, you have to keep listening, all right? And David Elfring, you have to keep listening too, because we're going to get to your question about diffraction and sharpness too. So
excellent.
thank you both for sending our emails and giving us something to talk about, because once you've done 50 podcasts, you're thinking, what do I talk about now? But there's always something. Now, I know this great website that might help you. It's audiotu.com. Apparently there's this guy there, Bruce, who's done about 50 photography podcasts.
Okay.
So just download all of them and it'll improve your photography immensely. Now, here's an idea, and one that I'm going to be trying soon, because I'm writing an article on color temperature for a magazine here called Better Photography.
Interesting.
The editor, Peter Eastway, has asked me to write an article on color temperature, and I'm going to do a bit of an... I've seen it done, and I want to do it myself. When you get Dave out, on the landscape or whatever, if you've got a bit of a moody sky, maybe it's a late afternoon, there's a bit of cloud, and it's a bit moody, try getting down low with a sort of slightly wide but not too wide lens, and shoot up at Dave. So he already has this sort of towering demeanor. He sort of, you're looking up, and it sort of makes people look that little bit more impressive. Great for sort of musicians and people who want a little bit of celebrity status.
Yep.
So your perspective is low, and your viewpoint is low, and you're looking up. Set your color temperature to tungsten. So that what will immediately happen is that your image will suddenly become quite blue. because it's compensating for the warm light that you it thinks you're shooting in, which
right.
would be normally tungsten, okay?
Yeah, which would be a very orange light.
Yeah, which, that's right. And then get your flash off camera and put a bit of orange cellophane or some sort of warming color. A lot of flashes actually come with sort of warming filters, but if not, a bit of orange cellophane will do. Get it off camera and point it directly at Dave. So what happens is you get this offset of color temperature whereby the camera shoots the ambient light that the flash doesn't highlight or illuminate and creates this moody blue cold sort of feeling while the orange filter on the flash
balances the negates color temperature that of the and white balance.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Now, as for exposure, I'm not sure of the make of your flash and that kind of thing, but it's digital. I'd say you just have to experiment with that.
Well, the flash is actually one I've had since I had my analog kit. It's called Nissin, Nissin.
Okay, and it's probably got a thyristor automatic mode, I would presume.
Maybe.
Whereby, have a look at that, because you might be able to just use it on its auto mode. Set your camera at the aperture that the flash suggests for any particular ISO in its auto mode, and it should work. It should work. It should give you, because what happens, the way that the old thyristor auto modes used to work in flash was that the flash had a sensor on the front, and it was related to a particular aperture setting that the back of the flash would suggest you set on your camera for any particular ISO. So if you're shooting at, say, ISO 100, your flash might say, at ISO 100, set the camera at f5.6, and the flash will adjust its output according to the sensor that on the front that sees what's happening for f5.6. It may take a little bit of experimentation on your part, but you should be able to do that. You should be able. It should be able to work. You've got an off-camera lead. You're able to connect it and synchronize it with the camera. So give that a try, and of course, I will be interested to see what you come up with.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'll be quite happy to post some photos when I've got them.
You're a brave man, Bruce, but that's the nature of our fraternity, our photography fraternity.
Now, I've just grabbed my flash out of my bag.
Okay.
It says it's a Nissin Auto 3000 AFZ thyristor.
Well, there you go.
So it's got switches for all your ISO settings from 25 to 800.
Right, because after 800, you hardly need a flash.
Exactly. But all that switch does is just move the little guide on the back.
Okay.
Like it's just moving the numbers. But does that actually change anything about the way the flash performs?
Not really. All it does is it tells you the aperture that you should set your camera at, your lens at.
To get so many feet of coverage.
Yes, exactly. And also, because naturally at different ISOs, you have different sensitivity. The flash is saying, look, this is the way this flash works. It will output this much, and you need to set this aperture. The auto mode uses the sensor on the front to adjust its output.
Okay, so how does that work? Because there's no setting on the back to set it to any sort of auto mode.
I'd have to probably look at the flash there. Mm. If it says that it's thyristor, then it does have... Thyristor was a power-saving mode that flashes from the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, until we got all the TTL stuff happening.
Right.
That they used to save power. Flashes before that, you just had one manual output.
Boof.
You would adjust your aperture according to distance, based on the guide number versus distance versus ISO sort of calculations. But you would, with the thyristor, what it actually did is there was a sensor on the front, which when you pointed your camera and thus your flash at the subject, the sensor on the front would see what the flash was outputting, see that the subject had received enough light according to its calibrated settings, and then shut the flash off when it says, okay, that's cool, we've got enough light now. And it would actually vary the output according to what the sensor saw.
So it does that a nanosecond before the flash actually fires?
It does it during the flash exposure.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So it would, and it would cut the flash off and say, okay, we've received enough light. And it was a power-saving thing, and it was also an automated exposure thing. So what you should be able to do is set your camera up for an ambient exposure setting that, let's say your flash suggests that ISO 100, if that's what you're going to use, 5.6. Let's just pull a number out of the air. Set your camera at 5.6 and find out at that aperture what the shutter speed setting is.
Yeah.
Now, I hope everybody's listening, because this is a great way to use fill flash with the old flash units as well.
Yeah.
You would then set your flash up and basically see how it goes. What you might actually want to do is set your shutter speed maybe a stop faster than the shutter speed suggested, so that you underexpose the ambient light a little and let the flash do most of the work.
Right.
It's that playoff between aperture and shutter speed when you're using flash that will actually dictate the effect of the flash. You know, so maybe if your ambient exposure is 125th at f5.6, maybe it's, you know, really sort of dusk, and that's the sort of aperture shutter speed combination you're getting.
Yep.
Then maybe
it up
set
to 250.
Yeah, pop it. As long as it's not, of course, breaking your sync speed, which with your camera, I don't think it is. So that will sort of underexpose the ambient, but your flash will come through because your aperture setting is still the same.
Right.
And it's all about the aperture, really, with the in that sort of setting. So give that a try. It'll be a little bit of an experimentation, but of course you've got your digital screen to check the results each time.
Yep.
And see how that goes. But use the auto setting. Now, failing that, just go to manual and work with that according to...
Do a couple of test shots and then go next.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But you should be able to work with the auto thyristor mode and get the effect you're after, because as long as you don't cover up the sensor on the front, which is usually just a tiny little dot, you know, it's a very...
It's a like a red screen. Is that the thing you're talking about?
That would probably be the
like
sensor.
Like you have on an infrared remote control, that kind of thing?
That could be a couple of things with a flash, but it's probably the sensor in this case. I'd have to look at it to know, and you and I being 1,200 kilometers apart,
that's a bit hard.
next time we share a Cabernet Sauvignon together, we'll have a look at it, Matt.
Absolutely. But,
for the moment, I think that'll be the way that you'll travel. So give that a try. When I was shooting weddings years ago, I still shoot weddings, but when I was using non-TTL flash equipment, it was that thyristor auto that I used for my fill flash all the time.
Right.
And I would depending on the day, I would use that auto mode to vary the effect, you know, of the flash. For instance, if the flash suggested that at 100 ISO I use f5.6, you know, I would vary my aperture so that the flash would be, you know, less effective, less overwhelming in the image. I might set my camera to f8 or f11 so that the flash, thinking it only has to provide enough light for 5.6, actually came in under what it would normally do.
Yep.
If I was set at f8, the flash thinks it only has to work hard enough for f5.6. It only has to provide this much light because we've got the camera set at f5.6, so it would fire this amount of light.
Yeah.
But I would have my camera actually set at f8 or f11, and there'd be a one or two stop difference, making the fill flash just more subtle.
Yeah.
Nice. And that was a way that we used to, you know, work around fill flash in the old days.
Now,
way back when.
Coming back to that trick you were talking about with the auto white balance and some orange cellophane.
Yes.
Now, for tungsten light, you've got a fairly low color temperature, is that right?
Tungsten is a very warm light. Well, actually, technically, it's a cold light. It's an
orange
light.
What's the Kelvin
light
on that?
About 3,400.
Okay.
So you could actually set your camera to that number if you want, but a tungsten setting on your white balance manual sort of tungsten setting, you see the little icon, will do it.
So what sort of, could you go the other way as well, like with blue cellophane, is there a color temperature that you could go the other way so that you would get all your surrounding sort of really rich and red and have Dave natural color?
Yes, you could set your camera gives you the ability to actually pick a number in your
white
balance.
I can dial in Kelvin, yeah.
Well, if you can dial in Kelvin, just go up to 8 or 9 or 10,000,
right?
And you'll get you and you'll get the opposite effect.
Ah,
so you could do that. Yes,
nice.
You can actually do that. When I was at Salina Grande in Argentina, we were at sunrise, and I actually did two shots. One with the setting very blue, or very, you know, with a tungsten white balance, say down around the 3,000 mark.
Yep.
And then I did another shot with it up to the 10,000 mark, and it looks, you know, one looks cold and early morning, and you know, and then the other one looks really warm and hello, the sun's up,
yeah.
And they were only taken seconds apart.
Oh, nice.
So that's the value of playing with your color temperature. So you could look, get a bit of blue cellophane,
yeah,
and get a bit of orange cellophane, and see what effect you come up with.
Yeah,
it's actually
definitely.
going to be something I'm going to be writing about very, very soon.
Cool.
So give that a try.
Something I'm also going to try, because I don't actually have a proper reflector. I've got one of those, you know, those screens you put over the windscreen of your car, the ones that are circular that you sort of twist and fold down.
Yes.
Yeah, and it's got a silver side to it. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking of taking that along with the tripod and some gaffer tape, and I can gaffer tape that screen to my tripod and use it as a reflector.
Yes, absolutely.
So I can fire the flash at the reflector and sort of get side fill if I want. And
yeah.
So I've sort of been kicking some ideas around. So
it's a neutral grey, so it's going to absorb some of the light.
Oh, okay.
It shouldn't reflect any odd colour, because if it's a fairly neutral sort of grey, it will absorb some of your flash output.
Yep.
But it should work very effectively. Photographers use all sorts of things as reflectors. A bit of white cardboard or and styrofoam, any of those things make great reflectors. So, you know, you can quite easily do that. Just get a bit of, you know, you can get a bit of chipboard or, you know, a bit of wood and spray paint thing. You can do all sorts of things to make a reflector. I mean, if you look at the Antonio shot that we've talked about that I took in Argentina, the reflector was the ground in front of him. So anything can act as a reflector, throwing light back. But definitely, you know, give that a try. But I think if you use your flash off camera, like we've been talking about, you'll get some interesting effects. I'll be really, you know, make it go off camera and maybe round to your right or left, depending on where you've positioned yourself, so that you've got light coming in from, you know, a different angle, creating, you know, three dimensions. So try and get it as angular to him as possible, and you know, maybe as high and as angular as possible. If you need to get an extension for your sink, you know, maybe just put your camera, if you've got two tripods or another stand or something to put your flash on, try and extend the difference maybe to, you know, 10 feet between your flash and your camera. Put the flash, you know, on a stand so it's a little high and shooting down on Dave while your perspective is low and shooting up.
Okay,
and you've got this interplay of your viewpoint being low so that it creates this idea of him being some sort of figure, some sort of overwhelming figure.
Yep.
And your light coming down on him, so, hey, I'm this overwhelming figure, but look, the sun shines bright on me. and because I am Dave, you know. And of course, if it's off to, you know, if let's say you're photographing him from down below, he's, you know, you're maybe down your to your left, he's, you know, or his right, and down below him, set the flash off to your right so that it comes in, you know, at an opposite angle to him, giving you a little bit of dimension and flash and lighting, so that it'll create an interesting interplay between the ambient light. You know, do this maybe at around dusk so that there's no sunlight mucking around with you, or try and, you know, find maybe an area where he doesn't actually have too much direct sunlight, if you possibly can, because you want your flash to be the source of light.
Right.
And see how you go with that. You want really the flash with the orange cellophane to be the source of light, which is why you may need to underexpose your ambient exposure a little bit, one or two stops, create that blue moody effect with the flash actually doing most of the work to provide the light. It should be an interesting interplay. I'd love to see how you go on that.
I think I'm starting to get more and more excited about it now, because that's given me a few ideas. So
yeah, well, it'll create a real moody, you know, interesting sort of shot that could work very effectively for the cover.
Excellent. Okay, well, thank you for that.
You'll get, Well, you'll get musos all over Australia wanting you to shoot your covers for CDs now, mate.
That's
I'll tell
fine
you
by
what,
me.
That'll be great. Yeah,
the only problem with musos is they don't have any money.
Yeah, yeah, unless they are Keith Urban or something.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
That country singer's just not only had some, but just married into a lot of it.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, well done to him. Well done to him. Marry a beautiful woman who's rich. That's an interesting concept.
There's a game plan for every man's life.
You know, yes, there's a game plan. He's not stupid. He's not stupid. A friend of mine remembers Keith Urban from, you know, his own gigging days up in New South Wales. He remembers seeing Keith Urban sitting in a pub in northern New South Wales playing to about four people.
Yeah, right. And
now, of course, you know, when he plays to four people, they're people he's having around for dinner. Otherwise, he's playing to thousands.
Exactly.
Well, let's answer David's questions and Paul's questions very quickly. Now, Paul, you asked about Flash. We've talked a lot about Flash, so let's stay on the subject just for a few moments. We have talked about Flash, and Paul, I don't know whether you've downloaded all of our podcasts, but I would go back to audiotu.com and revisit some of the titles of the podcast wherein I deal with the idea of Flash. But let's look at your question. You said, I read your article about compensating for fill flash by changing settings on the flash using the high-speed sync and combining it with natural light. Can you talk a little more about that? I'm not sure that I understand. You talk about the fact that you photograph Native Americans at www.powwows.com, and that the larger events are indoors, making the light not optimal. Now, here's the problem. We have to remember that no flash is going to be bright enough to illuminate an entire arena. So you may just need to settle for ambient light or available light and uprate your ISO, which means more noise and, you know, that kind of thing. But that's always been the case. At least we have the opportunity to do it. And the only thing in a large arena where you are indoors, like you say, for larger events, you just have to use flash straight, right? If indeed you use it at all. But I really doubt that it's going to have much effect if you're a fair distance away. I think I'd take for granted that you would know that because your flash can only illuminate, you know, so much. So, but if you're indoors and you're close, my suggestion would be, and I'll make this quick, use your flash by all means, but set your camera up so that you are photographing, you know, using as much available light as you can, and your flash is only supplementary. So that what happens is, let's say your internal exposure is 2.8 at a 30th of a second. Well, shoot at that. And set your flash up so that, and every system works differently, you might set it up so on a fill flash mode, you might set it up on a TTL mode, but maybe use the dial, the power down setting, you know, to make it maybe come in one stop under, so that it doesn't actually overwhelm your image and look like it's flashed, but just fills a little bit. You may use your camera's rear curtain flash setting so that the camera and flash already understand that your camera is going to take the shot at its available light setting, and the flash is going to come in just before the shutter curtain closes to fill in, you know, what's left and not overwhelm the image. Great for movement effects, especially if you're shooting at slower shutter speeds, you get this blur effect. And then the flash comes in just before the final curtain and gives you the still that you need to freeze the image. It's a great effect that National Geographic photographers started using in the late 1980s when cameras like the Nikon F4 and the Nikon 801s or N8008s, as they were in America, came in with that rear curtain sync mode. It's a fabulous method to use. Now, you're talking about the fact that the Native Americans you're photographing are dancing and singing. Well, there's the action you need for the movement. Why not try that so that don't be afraid to blur the image, because movement is about blur. If you're going to create the idea of movement in your image, blur the thing. You know, we often think, oh, I've got to get the fastest shutter speed possible because it's moving. No, not necessarily. If you have a blur, you're creating the idea of movement in an image, but if you're using rear curtain sync flash, what happens is you get that movement and the flash comes in, as I've said, just before the curtain closes on your shutter, gives you that frozen moment. So you have a mixture of blur and sharpness and, of course, light. That final burst of flash gives you the bright, properly illuminated image with a blur behind it. fabulous effect and may work very well for you in those sort of circumstances. So there's a few tips. If you're still not sure, might come back to me. We can revisit this as a complete Flash podcast or series of podcasts, because Flash is a fabulous tool. It's a pocket. You can pull light out of your pocket and bang, use it any which way you like. I've always just been against the fact that photographers stick it on their camera and boom away with it, and you know, tend to think that it's the answer to all their problems. It's a fabulous tool, provided it's used correctly. Give those things a try. Let me know how you go, Paul, and let me know if I have not answered your question as well as you would have liked. David, getting back to your question, you were talking about the fact that you'd visit Tom Hogan's website. Now, there's a great website, especially if you're a Nikon user. And Tom suggested that around F13, the APS-C size sensor begins to reveal diffraction. Now, what is diffraction? It's an interesting thing we need to remember. Light travels in a straight line, and when we put it through an aperture, of course, it bends. It goes through, it's squeezed through an aperture and comes out the other side. So we're actually bending the light as we close our apertures. And the smaller the aperture, the more we're bending that light. We have a playoff here because we use smaller apertures to increase sharpness. We use smaller apertures to increase depth of field. So, instead of, say, using f1.8, if we want greater sharpness, we'd go to maybe f8 or f11. But there gets a point where you can actually offset the gain in sharpness with the problem of diffraction, because the smaller your aperture, the more your light bends around the aperture and gives you, an effect, an optical effect called diffraction. And what diffraction basically does, there's a lot of technicalities to it, and I'm going to actually post a link to a website that, if you really want to get into it, will explain it all brilliantly. We'll post the link on audiotu.com.
Cool.
But it actually just simply, it reduces sharpness. And so there's this playoff between an increase in sharpness and depth of field. But yes, you do get to a point where it works against you.
Oh, really?
So, yeah. And this is especially the case with smaller size sensors, APS-C size sensors, etc. And look, we talk about, full frame sensors and APS-C size sensors. There's always going to be a compromise either way. The great thing about an APS-C size sensor is that because it's smaller, it uses the sweet spot of every lens. And my 85 1.8 at 1.8 is sharper than it used to be. And because I'm using a smaller sensor, I've got just that little bit more depth of field of f1.8 than I otherwise would have.
Plus all your analog lenses get a 1.5 boost.
Well, exactly. So my 85-1.8, which I've often spoken about with deep affection, and many of our listeners on this podcast have just gone out and bought one. I know a few of you have and shown me pictures that you've taken with them and how much you love it. I mean, it's just a great thing. Mm. But, for landscape photographers, it can be a little bit of a problem. But this is why a lot of the compact digital cameras and the prosumer cameras only go to, say, f8 or f9 in their aperture as the smallest aperture, because, one, the sensor is smaller. So f8 or f9, as we've talked about before on this podcast, is equivalent in depth of field terms to maybe f22 or 32 or whatever. If they actually had an f22 or 32, it'd be such a tiny little hole because the lens is small, the sensor is small. It'd be this tiny little dot of a hole of an aperture that the light coming through the lens would bend tremendously and would actually work against you by diffracting. Mm. So, yes, you're absolutely right. There gets to a point, and Tom Hogan suggests on his website, according to you, David, that it's about F13. I'd suggest that would vary from lens to lens, but maybe, at around F13, you start to say, well, this is about all the depth of field I'm going to need for an APS-C size sensor, because it's the equivalent of 22 or 32. David, you said that you once experimented with a large format 4x5 inch camera. You shot at f45 and it was incredibly sharp. Yes, that would be right, but you've got a 4x5 inch sensor, or medium, and you've got a much larger piece of glass, and the aperture is, you're not bending the light as much as you would with a smaller sensor and a smaller lens.
Because does this whole thing with diffraction, is that affected by the focal length of the lens you're using?
I wouldn't think so. I wouldn't think so. Something I should look up.
Okay, we can come back to that another week.
Yeah, leave that with me, everybody. Because it really shouldn't.
Right, so if F-13 is sort of the turning point for an APS-C sensor, it wouldn't matter whether you're shooting a 50mm lens or a 300mm lens. It would still be the same.
I would suggest so, because, of course, F-13 is the... although...
If I suppose it comes down to the diameter size, wouldn't it?
Well, it would, and actually it would. So perhaps it would vary from focal length to focal length as I think about it. Yes. So I'd need to look at the website you're talking about and see what Tom Hogan has come up with. Tom Hogan is, of course, a renowned photographer and camera tester, and he has actually put this to the test. So you could I'll check that out. But of course, if you're using a wide angle lens, f/22, like a 28mm or a 20mm in 35mm terms, an 11 or 10mm in digital terms, or 18mm, whatever it might be, yes, the actual aperture is a smaller hole than, say, it would be if you were using a 300mm or 400mm. So perhaps the diffraction would vary from focal length to focal length. Need to check on that, so leave that subject with me.
Excellent.
But there's David and Paul's questions hopefully answered. Appreciate both your comments too. David, you suggest that you don't mind our longer podcast. You're one of very many people who are saying that, so thank you. And also your compliments on my Argentina pictures are appreciated. Can I just tell everybody that I'm intending to go back next year, so if you want to join me, it's just going to be the shoot of a lifetime.
Yeah,
I'll have information posted at audio2u.com very soon on the upcoming tour.
Awesome. Okay, mate. Well, thank you very much for all of that. Particularly,
my pleasure.
Particularly, thank you for the advice for me for my impending shoot on Saturday.
Oh, no worries. Let me know how you go.
Yeah, definitely. Will do. Okay, as per usual, if you want to send Shelton an email, shelton@audio2u.com. Don't forget the GorillaPod survey. We've still got about, is it one or two more weeks left before we draw some names out of the hat? And I think that's about it.
Fabulous. Fabulous. Excellent. And thanks everyone again for listening, and thank you for sending those emails. Gives us, you know, an idea of what you want to talk about, what you need to know, and you know, more room to move in our podcast, and we appreciate that for sure.
Absolutely. Oh, and there's one other thing too. I happened a couple of days ago to log into my PayPal account because I was looking for details on a transaction. And what should I happen to find? But a whole heap of people have been by and made donations, and I didn't get any email notification from PayPal that these things had occurred. So I just want to say to the people who did make donations, please don't think I was being rude by not acknowledging it. I was simply unaware, and I don't know why I've not been getting the emails. I went into my preferences on PayPal, and all the boxes were ticked to say, send me an email when a transaction occurs. But for some reason, it hasn't happened. I don't think they've gone through to my junk mail folder. I've looked in there. So to everybody who has made a donation, thank you very, very much. It is greatly appreciated.
Good on you. Thank you. Because it's, you know, that's the generosity of your hearts and your volunteering. So, yeah, thank you very much for that.
Absolutely.
Very good of you.
All right, mate. We'll talk with you next week.
Look forward to it, mate.
See ya.
See you soon.
You've been listening to another Fresh Picked Pod from audio2u.com. Audio2u delivers the best quality podcasts direct to your desktop or portable.
You be the boss.
Hear what you want to hear.
When you want to hear it.
Hey, now that's a good idea.
Audio2u.com. Hit us today.
And remember,
Control D to bookmark.
Audio2u.com.